Contention is embodied in how we feel about the other person and their belief. I define contention as expressed or unexpressed negative interactions with another person and their beliefs, which create distance or contempt. It may surface as anger and argument, but can also be silently unexpressed or cloaked in politeness. It's not necessarily found in what we say to others, but in how we feel about them. Contempt is at the heart of contention, where we feel that we are better than the other person and that they have nothing worthwhile to offer us. We don't respect the other person as our neighbor, as a child of God, or as one who we can learn from. Instead of offering them dignity, something everyone desires, we feel contempt. They become an enemy or a villain, an object of pity and disgust. Jesus land if they live righteously.
It is time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, and I'm excited. I want to throw in the word trepidatious as we get into this episode. I look forward to the conversation that we have with my friend now, because the third time he's been here in the Cultural Hall, David Osler. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for letting me on.
Now, you hear Osler and you think related to, Papa Osler. Yes. David, the more attractive of the Osler brothers. Sorry, Richard. You guys have, I know there's you and I know there's Richard. And then you have a brother who's a professor. Is it just the three boys?
We have another brother who lives in Salt Lake, but he's not an author.
Okay. So we don't talk about him. You guys get together and it's like, oh, sorry, this conversation is for the Osler boys who have written books. So go ahead. And now where were you guys all raised?
In Salt Lake.
Okay.
Salt Lake proper. I'm a Highland High graduate. So we all grew up in the city.
And now have all kind of gone different places except,
So Richard's in Salt Lake. Okay. Jeff is in Eugene. I'm in Virginia.
And give me an idea of just real quick, because I always get curious about that stuff. So growing up years were when? Like when were you in high school?
So I graduated from high school in 75. So, I'm 66. So I'm kind of an older guy. And I'm the second brother. My older brother, Jeff, he's a professor of American history at the University of Oregon. He writes on Native American history in North America. That's kind of his area.
Hasn't ever taken the meander from like Native American history and how that intersects with Mormonism, or North American history and how that has integrated with Mormonism, anything like that? No, huh?
No, Jeff's just straight classic American history, and he's not close to the church at all, but he certainly is aware that that's a common discussion amongst Latter-day Saints.
Sure. And so if I'm getting this right, 75, a graduate of high school, then you're in like the, what some would call like the golden era of the church. Like you, that's blue and gold balls. That's the, the getting together of the, the region basketball tournaments and then the church-wide basketball tournaments in downtown Salt Lake. That's road shows once a year. Like that is the height of tradition, most of which we do not do anymore.
Yeah, we got the road shows and the basketball. We missed the gold and blue
and gold banquets or whatever they're called. Yeah.
Yeah. There were something that I recall vaguely is the MN and Gleaners.
Okay.
And they did, so I'm not in that generation, but okay. I think my parents were, but yeah, we had a pretty active life in the church. We had softball, basketball, volleyball, the full church athletic program, scouting was a really big deal. And, the church, partly because we lived in such a densely Latter-day Saint area, the church was synonymous with our social life.
I think that this sets actually the stage pretty well, not only because of my curiosities and I just wanted to ask you, but I think when we talk about division, when we think about the topic of your book, which is Healing Our Divides, Answering the Calls to Be Peacemakers, I think that a large portion of why there seems to be so much division is because we don't have the connection or the awareness, the interaction with other people. Would you say that is at least the foundation of why there's so much division?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, and it's one that I've read about. I'm not sure I'm an expert on it, so I'm not sure I'm kind of understanding why today is so difficult, so polarized, so much how our differences define our relationships in the communities that we live in. But clearly something is different today. It's not that way everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in Germany, Britain, France, Australia, kind of these divisions are less today than they were, say, 40 years ago. But in the United States, they have climbed significantly. We are, you know, never in my lifetime have we been this polarized.
Well, and, you know, we're recording this in the spring of 2024, long before whatever the train wreck that is November of 2024 occurs. And that doesn't matter which side of that you're on. This year will be difficult. If it's anything like it was 4 years ago and subsequently 8 years ago, it's just going to be hard. Times where I can remember, you know, I was a keyboard warrior, David. I got on and I was like, how could you possibly think that this would be the person? Don't you know Jesus stands for, you know, all the things, just spewing hatred and vitriol. And I'm a pretty reasonable person, you know?
Yeah. And it's worse now, right?
Yeah.
And we know that, you know, there's data that kind of quantifies this, and the amount of acceptance for political violence, if you measure that in the United States, is approaching what was found in Northern Ireland in the 1970s.
Jeez.
Now, we're not experiencing the level of violence, but the acceptance of political violence as pollsters measure it is equivalent. So, you know, I think this isn't just a topic that is interesting and maybe gets in the way of some of our relationships. I think it's maybe in some ways, a very critical topic that we address in 2024. And I don't see anything that would make it simpler in 2025 or 2026. You know, these are difficult times, and we need to understand better how we can navigate them personally, or they're going to rip us apart.
Why are you the guy to write about it?
I'm not sure I am, but...
But you did.
So, there's a lot of people that are working on this topic. To suggest that, I am wiser than them isn't really, I'm not. They're smarter.
And that's not what I'm suggesting. But
let me tell you the process I went through. So 2.5 years ago, we had a ward conference. It was lovely. And in the second hour, we reviewed Elder Renlund's talk on No More Contention. And it was a wonderful talk. I loved the talk. And we all kind of nodded our heads and said, we don't want to be contentious. So I kind of was thinking, as I sometimes do, and raised my hand and said, so how do we, what do we do then differently? And, as I thought about that, and I thought about some of the answers that came out and how I've kind of looked at this issue myself, there's a couple of alternative paths. And I think many of us simply retreat and say, it's a messy world. I don't want to get involved with it. And so I'm going to just retreat into kind of the peaceful world that I can find, and I can ignore topics that are contentious. I think there's other people that say,
Before we go to another option, tell me why that tactic might be both beneficial and what the negative impacts of retreat would be.
So I think it's a natural one for us to go to, first of all, because it says avoid contention. You know, we should avoid contention. So avoidance means to retreat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do need to retreat. Sometimes it's useful for us. But maybe the reason we retreat is because we don't have skills to be able to live indifference in a way that's productive and effective. And I think we live in a society that is complex enough with problems that we identify as being really important to solve. And we want to engage on that. We just don't know how to do that in a productive way, a way that's not going to create anger and contention and division and the like. And so the second path is to engage productively.
Okay. Tell me about that.
So what skills do we need to be able to do that? How do we sit down with people who have very different beliefs, whether they're religious or political or whatever kinds of beliefs they are? How do we engage in those in ways that don't create contention? Because having conversations about things that are different, where you believe this and I believe this, that isn't inherently contentious.
Sure.
We do that all the time. We navigate that, you know, what kind of ice cream to, you know, we're going to buy at the grocery store, to where we're going to go on a family vacation. We may all have differences of opinions, and we come to some sort of reasonable accommodation for people, you know, within ranges. So we can do that in some parts of our lives, but it's hard in those areas that seem to be kind of triggering contention. So, you know, there's some of those in the church and there's some of those in our communities.
Do you think that it's also because stakes are higher? I mean, I know you give sort of the example of like, what do we want for, you know, for dinner? And we sort of engage in these differences and, and we go, yeah, you know, I want sushi, or my wife wants Indian food. And it's like, okay, well, we're engaging in our differences. And we kind of go, you know what? It ultimately doesn't matter. We'll go and we'll have Indian food or whatever. That, not a big deal. But when you put it in the stakes of something like religious, of like, you know, I feel that it is this thing and that the church needs to move in this direction. And the other person is like, no, it needs to stay where it is. And this is needs to be the thing. And it's the literal definition of your salvation. Or, you know, politically putting it, it's, you know, the future of the country for the next 4 years. I mean, though there may be some similarities, it just seems like the weight of it is so much more. And so everything just becomes sort of exponentially larger. It's not even being triggered. It's just like the weight of it is so much more.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're exactly right on that. Where the stakes are highest, we're more prone to advocate or put forward our ideas in a way, you know, that reflect the significance of those stakes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily mean it has to be contentious. But it does mean that the stakes are higher. And so the outcomes of how we deal with that or how that affects us, I think, are more important.
We were talking kind of through some paths. We talked about retreating and engaging productively. Are there other paths that people can kind of walk through and take?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people that take a path towards contention. And they think that they need to advocate in such strong ways that they cross into lines of contention, whether that's physical violence or online behavior that we would recognize as being in some ways violent, but certainly contentious. I think some people enter that realm you know, they feel that they need to advocate for what they think is right in such strong ways that they diminish you know, the arena of discussion. They may not feel that they are contentious. They may feel that they are even righteous, advocating for what they think is right. And I think we've seen that in different expressions across all political ideologies over the last 10 years. Maybe we've always experienced that to some degree, but the arena seems to be more rife with those issues.
Do you think it is a conscious choice of contention, or like in some of the cases, and this is me just being vulnerable with my friend David, like there are times where I have become contentious, where I'm just like, it's because you're wrong. There is a right and there is a wrong. And like, I, you know, if it's like, oh, you know, agree to disagree and maybe there's some different solutions, like I'm that for all day. But when I feel like the other person is just wrong, and it's a feeling. I don't think in any cases of, you know, me getting really riled up about it that I can think, no, that was fundamentally the right answer or the right thing or whatever. Like I just get like a dog to a bone. It's like, no, admit you're wrong because you're wrong. You need to know that you're wrong. Can you not see how wrong this is? Do you think that we fall into it? It's a skills base that we just don't have? Or do you think it's a bunch of people consciously being like, I'm stirring this up and I hate you?
Well, it's probably all of the above. I think there is something natural about us as people that have a hard time dealing with difference. And I felt this with my book Bridges that I wrote. So, you know, this book, Healing Our Divides, to some extent comes out of Bridges, where people who leave the church, so to speak, are often misunderstood by those that stay in the church. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they fight, and sometimes they don't know how to talk about that difference. And sometimes they fracture their relationships. And just because now one doesn't worship the same way that they did previously, they become a villain or become a lesser than person. And the same is true in kind of the political arena. And so I think there's something natural about us. You know, it is the natural man that will take a set of differences and naturally feel alienated from that other person because they have those different beliefs, when we feel either a strong moral or righteous or intellectual belief or values on a particular position. So yeah, I think it's all of the above, but I think a lot of it is that we really don't get taught skills on how to deal with difference. So I think it's fundamentally a skills-based issue, where we don't have to be slaves to this natural part of us that is prone to contention, and we can engage with people who have different beliefs without getting riled, without saying things that we later regret, without having, you know, hormones enter our nervous system that cause us to say things where we're kind of listening to ourselves talk, mm-hmm. you know, and I think we've all done that. And, you know, where we just can't, you know, hold back.
Yeah.
So I think there are skills that we need to learn. I think we have to learn how our minds work. And I think we have to learn why certain things create the conditions for us to enter into contention. So, I mean, that's why I felt I needed to write a book about it. And I kind of stepped out of that class of we don't want to be contentious to I want to live in a world. I want to be able to engage with my family members, with my community that has different beliefs, but I don't want to try and tear it all down. I want to be able to do it in a productive way, sometimes learning things that I, you know, needed to relearn, sometimes suspending the difference so that I can maintain a strong relationship, but also sometimes so that I can learn to advocate for what I think is important in society in a way that doesn't cause contention and creates the best groundwork for coming to common solutions that consider the needs and the interests of people other than me.
I love that you couch it in the idea that, you know, the natural man is sort of this contentious thing, and, you know, what I love about it, I guess, is what I'm saying is I hear you say that. And then that instantly, because the phrase, the natural man, has such a religious context to me, you know, a desire to put off the natural man, to be able to become more like God by putting off the natural man, essentially. And sometimes I think that within the church, we think it's so very much of like, I need to make better choices, or I need to go to the temple more, I need to look a certain way, do a certain thing, and all those. And I like that, if I'm understanding you correctly, that some of that putting off of the natural man in this case is literally just a skills-based like lesson, or skills-based skills sounds redundant, but I can't think of the word that I want to do. But it's a skills-based like tactic of, you can put off the natural man if you take the time to learn particular skills to be able to deal with this differently. It's like why I like the Fifth Sunday lessons, when they're like, now we're going to tell you about teaching a budget and being a good steward. It's like, great, step one, a step two, a step three. Now I can kind of do these things, where sometimes a gospel principle, though I recognize it is, you know, intertwined with gospel principles, you know, sometimes sort of feel more theory and a little bit more in flux. There can be things that we can just go, hey, This is a thing that you can do. Work on this skill. This is a skill that you can, if not master, become better in. And then there's another skill, and then there's another skill. I want to take a quick break. When we come back in the second block, I want to talk about and really sort of flesh out some of those skills that we can do better as we heal our divides. We'll come back and do that in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Here in the second block of the Cultural Hall, remember that you can become a Patreon saint of the Cultural Hall. Go to patreon.com/the Cultural Hall. There is a way that you can put your money where your ears are. We love that those people that think, hey, you know what? My life would be different if the Cultural Hall weren't around, and decide to open up their wallets or their digital checkbooks, if you will, and say, hey, you know what? I'll give those guys a couple bucks a month. Thank you to everyone that is a Patreon saint, and to all future Patreon saints. Thank you for helping the show continue to go. Now 800 episodes plus 13 years. Wow. Time flies. Patreon.com/the Cultural Hall. So take me back. You said you're in this class, you're talking about Elder Renlund's talk, you're talking about contention. You said, yeah, but how do we do that? Do you remember some of the responses that were shared in that class, for better or for worse?
There weren't a lot. I mean, I think the general response is, well, I just avoid situations that I know will be contentious. Mm-hmm. And I left pretty unsatisfied with, If that's the only thing we do, then we as Latter-day Saints are just building bomb shelters waiting for the second coming. Mm. You know, that's not the way, I have lived my life. We talked about where I grew up. I grew up in Salt Lake, but I've lived in other places. And I've served a mission in Japan. I've lived in India, lived in West Africa. I've lived in the UK. I've lived amongst people that are different. And my life is really rich because of that. Some are Latter-day Saints, some are not Latter-day Saints, but, you know, I've learned a great deal, and I don't want to sit in a bomb shelter, just letting it all happen around me. I want to be positively engaged in the world. So one thing I kind of tried to understand is, what is contention? You know, what is at the root of it? And, I'm just going to read a little section that I think distills this. Contention is embodied in how we feel about the other person and their belief. I define contention as expressed or unexpressed negative interactions with another person and their beliefs, which create distance or contempt. It may surface as anger and argument, but can also be silently unexpressed or cloaked in politeness. It's not necessarily found in what we say to others, but in how we feel about them. Contempt is at the heart of contention, where we feel that we are better than the other person and that they have nothing worthwhile to offer us. We don't respect the other person as our neighbor, as a child of God, or as one who we can learn from. Instead of offering them dignity, something everyone desires, we feel contempt. They become an enemy or a villain, an object of pity and disgust. So to me, that I needed to kind of get to, what is contention? What is at the heart of it? And the heart of it is these feelings I have about people who believe differently. I feel they are wrong. I feel they're immoral. I feel they are beneath me. I feel they're my enemy. And when I have those feelings, I have contention. And I can live in my bomb shelter with those feelings. I can live in the public space with my feelings. I can live in Twitter or Facebook with those kinds of feelings. I can change those feelings and remove them and look at everyone as being a child of God, as someone having worth, as someone who has a different perspective that might be different than mine. It might be completely wrong, but I still recognize in them that seed of divinity That they are entitled to their opinion, that something has happened in their life that brings them to that point. And that changes me and changes my interaction.
So if I
think this is really hard stuff, Richie. I think this is, you know, really gets to an aspect of discipleship that is, you know, it's embodied in love our neighbors as ourselves, but it's not a platitude. It's deep work that I have found I need to do to be able to step away from those natural tendencies towards enemy creation and feelings of disgust.
I'm going to take a page out of your playbook then, and I'm going to ask you, how do we do this? Obviously, the book, that's what this is all about. And I'll mention again that people will be able to get a link in the show notes so that they can purchase the book, and strongly recommend that people do it. Shout out to Coford Books, who made this interview possible. Healing Our Divides, Answering the Savior's Call to Being Call to Be Peacemakers. But how do we do this? Because I agree. You just said, and if I was an evangelical, I'd go, that preaches. And I'd go, yeah, I'm on board. And then you go, well, you need to do it. And I go, well, I mean, okay, I'll try, but I don't know how. Are there baby steps? Are there first rungs of the ladder to be able to do that? Because there are some people that, like, they just start talking and I go, can't take it anymore.
So I wrote the book. It has kind of multiple sections to it. Mm-hmm. There's a section that kind of frames up the issue and what's going on in the U.S. today, what's going on in Latter-day Saint culture. We have these divisions that exist within inside our own wards. So I frame up the issue. I also describe a little bit about how our minds work. We need to understand the natural mind. But most of the book is a set of practices and skills. So I lay out a skill, and we can just talk about a couple of these skills today. So one skill is to decide what you want out of the conversation. What are your objectives in having the conversation? And if you're going to have a conversation with two people, if two people are going to have a conversation and one favors legalization of abortion in all but rare circumstances, and one favors making abortion illegal except in rare circumstances, that's a potentially contentious discussion. Mm-hmm. So the question is person A enters that discussion, what do they want out of that discussion? And there's four or five objectives one could establish. One could be, I want to build a relationship with this person, and I'm not going to let their difference in abortion determine how I feel about them coming out. They might be my mother or my brother or my friend, my coworker, and I know they believe differently than me, but I want a relationship with them. And so my goal is to somehow or other strengthen the relationship. And if I enter into the conversation with that as my goal, I'm going to approach it differently. I'm going to have different questions. I'm going to respond differently. I'm going to keep that in the center of my mind. And I'm going to have that be the focus of what we're going to talk about. And if it grows heated, I may just say, you know, Sally, I know we have differences on that. Tell me about your family. You know, help me. You know, tell me about your last vacation. And we're going to change the topic because that pathway down a discussion about abortion isn't effective. A second approach would be to understand the other person's opinion and how they arrived at what they believe. So something about that person caused them to come to that belief. So in this way, we're really interrogating who they are, what experiences they've had that have led them there. We're not asking them to defend their belief. Mm-hmm. We're asking them to describe what in their life has brought them there. And it may be their religious beliefs. It may be something that's happened in their past. It may be relatively unexamined, and they've never really thought about why they believe that particular thing. So that's a goal of, I want to understand you. I want to understand what's in your mind. And you would use questions like, I'd be curious to know, what experiences have you had? When did you first feel that? Have you had any experiences with, you know, that topic? And you really approach that not wanting to know their belief, but the steps that got them there. in the process, you're going to learn something because they're going to see things differently than you. You may not change your belief, but you're going to be curious. And when we're curious, we're open. And when we're open, we sometimes learn things.
Yeah, I like that a
approach,
lot.
The third approach is, I'm going to tell you you're wrong.
This is my favorite of all the approaches, by the way.
And it's like the least effective, but we do it so much. You know, it's least effective and most commonly done. So I'm going to testify to you. I'm going to quote scripture at you. I'm going to tell you the podcast to listen to. I'm going to tell you you're wrong. It never works. It only reinforces the other person's belief. I mean, at least that's what all the psychology says. Mm-hmm. When you tell someone they're wrong or give them unsolicited advice, they just retrench and form stronger opinions about that. So we do this the most. It's the least effective. It's counterproductive, and it's the most alienating. And the other is, there are more effective techniques to try and have someone's beliefs change. We do that. We send missionaries out in the world, and mostly what they do is they ask questions. They become curious. They ask how people arrive. They ask if anything could change their mind. They ask them if they're open to thinking about things differently. And if they are, then things can change. And if they're not, then you need to change your goal. So that's just one simple step. Think about what your objective is.
I'm just going to take a quick note of this because it's definitely something I know need to work on. So I like the kind of juxtaposition in this about mission work to political warfare, I'm going to call it for this, because I can remember as a missionary knocking on a door and the person who said, you know what, I'm glad you're here. I can't wait to open your eyes. And I remember this guy vividly because he did hands next to his eyes. They were kind of like the pucker or mouth hands, and he's like, I want to open your eyes. I just want you guys to open your eyes and see how wrong, you know, what you're doing is, that the Mormon church, just open your eyes. He kept doing that. And not effective, by the way, what he did. But also when we would teach, yeah, we would never think to be like, hi, I would like to tell you today why you're wrong. Do you have a few minutes that we could come into your home? It sounds ridiculous. And maybe there are people who do this, but that certainly was not the approach that we would take. It would be things like, you know, we believe in God. Do you believe in God? Oh, okay. You come from a faith tradition. Tell me about that. And so it really was these sort of asking questions. But I don't think that, you know, when people make a statement, especially like in social media or in a public forum about something political, if I feel differently, my inclination is to not go, yeah, I wonder why. I wonder, you know, what their life experience of that is. I instantly sort of back on my heels and I'm just like, you're wrong. And I'll tell you why. Maybe because of the statement or just because of the forum or just because it is easier for me to connect to it in a religious way, but not in a political way. But I love that, thinking about the objective of what you want from that conversation and then being able to align your behavior with it.
Let me give you a second tool.
Okay.
This tool is called in-grouping.
In-grouping?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
We have, there's something in our minds. I'll just step back and explain why this is important. Psychologists identify that people have in-groups and out-groups. So an in-group would be, I'm a Latter-day Saint, and I think of Latter-day Saints in particular ways, and I think of non-Latter-day Saints as not being a part of that group. Mm-hmm. If I'm a Republican, I think of Democrats as not part of my group. There's all sorts of grouping that we do here. Political psychologists have designed these studies that measure this in-grouping. So they'll take a group of Republicans and show them pictures of people and ask them to rate their attractiveness. And then they tell them that they're Republican. They don't do it in the same study. But if they tell them that the pictures are people that are Republicans and ask them to rate the attractiveness of the person, they give them a higher score than if they are from the other political party.
Hmm.
So we look at people in our in-group more charitably, actually more physically attractive, than we do people in our out-group. And if they're in our out group, we're more skeptical of them. We're more skeptical of what they say. And apparently we also think they're less attractive. So I think that's kind of a funny study, but it shows the effect of in-grouping and out-grouping. So if I perceive a conversation with someone, let's go back to this pro-choice, pro-life discussion. If my identity is about that difference, then I'm going to treat them skeptically. But if I find some other commonality that pulls them into my group, and I think of them as a family member or other aspects of commonality and pull them into my group, then I'm less likely to be contentious, less likely to be skeptical of them, less likely to see them as my enemy or ugly. And it's embodied in the words that we use. So if I call them my enemy, even subconsciously, they are in my outgroup. If I call them right-wing nut jobs or left-leaning anarchists, socialists, Nazis, fascists,
communists,
you know, pick your label.
Don't forget communists.
Social, you know, they're America haters, you know, whatever the term is that we use on people who have different political ideologies. If we use that, we make them into our outgroup. If we simply think about them, maybe the most basic in grouping is they're children of God. And they have different political beliefs, but they are children of God. And if we can see them through that lens, it helps. I even rewrite the scriptures a little bit. So, you know, in Matthew, where it says that we should love our enemies, mm-hmm. I've gone back to other interpretations of that scripture. And I like using the version that says, love those people that hate you. I don't like loving my enemies because I don't think I really have any enemies. Maybe there are some people that are so vile and so, you know, have such beliefs that they are enemies. But I prefer to think of them as simply people that have different beliefs so that I can in-group. And when I do that, their ugliness melts away. The threat of their beliefs melt away. I find more commonalities with them. So that's just a simple thing. I mean, it seems kind of weird and trivial, but if I put you in an fMRI machine and had you think about your political opposites, a different part of your brain lights up than if you think about someone who's in your political group. So it's actually part of our biological framework that this in-grouping, out-grouping is there.
You talk about it being one of the most basic in-groupings. We're all children of our heavenly father or our heavenly parents, right? And I kind of like that because in some cases maybe that is the only in-group. I don't know to walk out all the other ones, but to be able to have that. Although here's the thing that I think about, and I would welcome any sort of advice about it because yes, if I can get to the point where I am like that, just another child of God making different choices. I feel like if I can connect to it, that's great. But how many times have I been like, they're just another children of family parents. They're just another child. Why are they dead? Were you adopted? You're not part of this family. Like that's almost, I say it jokingly and humorously, but that is genuinely how I feel in some cases. I can't, I know I need to, I know it would be better. I know now I understand some of the like psychology and study around it, but it is a hard thing to do in some cases.
Yeah. And there's some other tools in the book that kind of talk about that. There's something that describes what is the optimal setting for having these kinds of conversations. And it deals with time and parity of power. And, you know, social media is like the worst possible place to have these kinds of conversations. There's other places that are just a lot more effective. For having these kinds of conversations. So if we need to have them, if we want to have them, how do we do that? One of the parts of the book that I'm still thinking about, I wrote it, and maybe in 3 years I would rewrite it differently, is how do we engage, what kind of society do we want here? How much accommodation do we make? How much, I don't want a society where it's just, we're all, you know, live and let live, and your view is just as important and valid as my view. I don't think that's the right world. I think we have to enter into a world where we're so committed to each other that we're willing to embrace the difference and wrestle with it. And wrestle with it to the point that we know what kind of compromises we're willing to make to accommodate that other point of view. We may never come to that kind of accommodation, but we're always committed to that other person. There's this group called the Templeton Institute that has something called covenantal pluralism, where they describe this deep commitment that people can make in these kinds of discussions. They're not national election discussions. They're what happen in our homes or our communities or our churches, where we're so committed to each other, to understanding the needs of each other, that we wrestle with these issues. And a good example of that to me was where Utah passed, I think it was in 2015, what's called the Utah Compromise, which embodied non-discrimination language in law, in housing and employment with regards to sexuality and gender identity. Both aspects were codified into non-discriminatory requirements, and also religious freedom was written into law to protect churches from having to change their religious beliefs to accommodate these kinds of issues. And the church, and the way I understand it, as it's been described, there were long discussions for even years where people tried to understand each other so that they could craft some sort of accommodation that reflected the legitimate interests of each other. And those kinds of models are rare in politics, where both groups really felt that it was successful. They're on the record, you know, talking about what an important process this was. But it was because they had a deep commitment to understand the needs of other people, and they found that commonality, and they were able to craft language that put that in place. In this was a political setting, but it could be in other places. And I'm not a political leader. I don't have any power, but this is what I can do in the 300 people that I interact with. You know, I can do that with them, and we can wrestle with some of these issues, and we can find accommodation. In the process, I can learn about other people, where they're coming from and why the issue is so important to them. And we can find common ground. But it's not some apathetic live and let live, and, you know, all views are, you know, good. They're not. You know, there's a lot of views. We're not going to go back to slavery, you know, if I have a say about it.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to find more productive engagement than simply marching into a school board meeting and trying to shut it down, or, you know, other forms of civil disobedience that create big spectacles. But there is a tension there, and I'm not sure that I have that tension completely, you know, figured out. I think for me personally, and for what I wrote in the book, I'm kind of satisfied that it's the best I can do right now, but I'm open to getting better at it.
Is the book for people that find themselves really struggling with this, and it's sort of like an instructional? Is it just like, if you've been curious about, you know, healing a divide, tell me who you really hope this gets in the hands of?
I hope it gets into the hands of everyone, because I don't know anyone that's really very, I know a handful of experts. Mm-hmm. I think we're all works in progress on this. And I would say that society, I don't think society has a thinking mind, but there's many things in society that unteach these principles. You know, there's reasons why we have learned to in-group. There's reasons why we've learned to be angry about other people. There are interests in society that want us to go that direction. Mm-hmm. And they influence us. They influence, you know, the next generations. You know, I didn't grow up in this world of hyperpolarization, but my grandchildren are growing up in that. And I don't want them to just have this cultural wave of contention and polarization define the way they see life. So I actually hope it's something for everyone. There's some things I put in this book that I haven't put in, you know, I didn't put in Bridges. One of the things that I did is I have little thought boxes throughout where, you know, I'll put a comment, I'll put something out, and then I'll ask the reader to just stop and kind of think about that concept. Find like a time when they had a situation where they stepped back afterwards and said that didn't go real well, and to examine a particular principle. There's exercises in it where you can sit down with a friend and, you know, practice the skill. There's book group questions that people who want to read this together can focus in on and can have discussions together on. So I've really tried to put it in a way that it's something that we can learn from collectively. But, you know, I go back to it because I'm still not great at everything. And sometimes I've entered a conversation and I have to kind of go back, oh, that's a chapter seven principle. You know, what did I write there? Yeah. How do I do that? I really want to do that, you know, and that does. So, you know, I'm still a work in progress, but I wrote the book, and in my own mind, it's something that I refer back to periodically. And I was so pleased as I was writing this when President Nelson gave his general conference talk about a year ago about peacemakers needed. You know, and one of the things that he said in that is he said, building bridges of understanding will require much of you.
Yeah.
And I think he was aware of the effort that is required here. And I just think it's a part of discipleship is that we have to get into these issues and we have to feel, I think we as Latter-day Saints can have a unique role in society, being the peacemakers that maybe helps us navigate these really difficult times.
Yeah, the principle of healing, I find to be fascinating if you think about like when you cut your finger, you're cutting, you're making dinner or whatever, right? And then your body starts into a process of being able to heal itself. It's from a medical standpoint, I'm sure it's, you know, all the things and that this has to be carefully this and this is how this goes. But it is a miraculous work that occurs within your body to heal something like that. And I think things like this, it also is a work. It is skills. It is the desire. You'll never arrive at, you know, this healing if you don't desire it. It's something that you have to seek after. It's something that, as you just mentioned, that you do and do poorly, and then you do next time you do it a little bit better, or maybe the next time you do it really great, but then the next time you do it horribly. And I just think it is necessary. When you started to speak of, you know, grandchildren in a world that they wake. Growing up in, and I just think, in a lot of ways, it's what we are doing now for those generations in the future. I mean, like the time to change those generations in the future is now, not when the generations in the future. So I think that that's a critical thing that I had not considered sort of going into this conversation. I do want to take one more quick break. We come back in the third block. There are three questions that we ask everyone who steps in the cultural hall. We'll get those in here. And then also, maybe we got another one or two questions we'll pick up. We'll come back and do that in the third block. BestDJInUtah.com is the website. That is where you go if you would like me to come and DJ your event. Now, will I do a family reunion where you all wear the same t-shirts? You bet I will. Will I travel to wherever you're at? Uh-huh. Am I reasonable as far as what I cost? Yes. Yes. Do I bring a good time? Yeah, all the things. Listen, Best DJ in Utah, it's my company. It's a thing I do that allows me to be able to have the time to do the cultural hall. So if someone's getting married, you think, man, they need a great DJ. You're throwing a party, whether it's a 50th or 60th or 40th or 20th or whatever the party is. I've done them all and would love to be able to do that. An anniversary party, certainly done those. I did a baptism in 2023. Yeah, we did a big dance party at a baptism. Spoiler, not a Mormon baptism, but it was fun nonetheless. BestDJInUtah.com is a website. I will get back to you within 24 hours with a quote. Come on now. BestDJInUtah.com.
Hi friends, Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. You can get a brand new PC Laptops desktop and they start at only $29 a month. And it comes with a lifetime warranty. Just check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, remember, you can always send us an email, contact@theculturalhall.com. If you love this episode, if you have a guest suggestion, if you hate this episode, if you would like to understand more about this episode and we could create a dialogue, I would welcome that as well. contact@theculturalhall.com. Always open. You can do it when you get that, that hair when you wake up in the middle of the night and go, I should send him an email. Do it. It won't wake me up and I can read it when I wake up. contact@theculturalhall.com. So it seems like you mentioned President Nelson, talking about being the peacemakers. It seems also, I remember a talk sort of adjacent to all this with Elder Holland and Elder Oaks as well. Talking about the divided nature of the United States or the contention in general and just like these times, this very specific time, which is why I love that the book is coming out now in this, take a deep breath, election year. Are there any of those apostles or prophet or anything that you have been particularly struck by? Obviously, aside from the President Nelson peacemaker talk that you could share?
Yeah, it's interesting to me. Almost all of the first presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve have talked about this one way or another. But there's a talk that President Oaks gave at the University of Virginia. So it's not a general conference talk. It was a talk that he gave kind of in a setting as certainly as a church leader, but in a very legal way, talking about kind of the public process that we live in. Mm-hmm. And this is what he said that I think is really wise guidance to us. He said, we should accept the reality that we are fellow citizens who need each other. This requires us to accept some laws we dislike and to live peacefully with some persons whose values differ from our own. Extreme voices influence popular opinion, but they polarize and sow resentment as they seek to dominate their opponents and achieve absolute victory. Such outcomes are rarely sustainable or even attainable, and they are never preferable to living together in mutual understanding and peace. And then he puts the great example here. Followers of Christ also have a duty to seek harmony. In the midst of conflicts, all should seek peace. Far from being a weakness, reconciling adverse positions through respectful negotiation is a virtue. And maybe speaking to political leaders here and not to people like me, maybe you're one of those aspiring political leaders and it will be you. I'm not. But in my world, that respect of reconciling adverse positions still applies. It applies to my neighbors who aren't Latter-day Saints and how I treat them religiously. It includes those that have been Latter-day Saints that are no longer, that have left. It includes people in extreme political positions. They aren't my enemies. They are children of God. We need to find ways that we as a people, as a country, as congregations can have more peace. And it starts with me. It's not them that need to change. Well, maybe they do too, but I need to change. I can be better at this.
Yeah. And you can control you. You can't control anyone else. And that's, I think, a sort of valuable thing. A couple things that I would just comment on. I was listening to an interview with former presidential candidate Ramaswamy, and he talked about, and I've heard this from several other places as well, about 80% of, and this, I'm sure it's not an exact thing, but about 80% of American public, we're fairly united, right? We don't have these things that are so polarizing, but only the 20% maybe that has these extreme things. But that if you watched any sort of news, depending, it does not depend on which channel or source you get, they will very much be like, it is this and not that. And it drives ratings, and people that need to raise money need you to outgroup the other person and in-group this because it's got to be this person. And for me, I think the reason why I'm so excited to be able to read more into the book, learn more about this, and why I think it's so valuable is I don't want to be controlled by somebody else. I don't want, you know, I want to be in charge of who I am. And I think it's a valuable gospel principle. And then I would just say one more thing on top of it. I have been so angry before, so angry to the point that like I couldn't focus within a day, or, you know, it just is the consuming text back and forth. And I didn't feel well, physically didn't feel well. You talked about like the brain, you know, chemicals and all those things. It was addicted to the, you know, stirring this up and all that. And I just don't want that. So I think that there are a lot of, there's a lot of greatness that comes out of the words, the principles that you share. And so I, you know, I deeply appreciate you. This is, we have only touched on just a little bit of the great research that you've done and you've put into the book that people can be able to consume. There is a link in the show notes. People can purchase it. It's called Healing Our Divides, Answering the Savior's Call to Be Peacemakers. David Osler is my guest. It's from Greg Coford Books. So again, a shout out for them. They're always really great about being able to connect us with their authors and then being able to have these conversations around that. You know, from being here before, there are three questions that we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall, and I will ask those of you now. The first question is, do you have a calling, sir? And if so, what is it?
Teach 16-year-olds in Sunday school.
How do you like it?
I like it. They're smart.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Teaching 16-year-olds.
Are you one, let me ask you just an aside question on that. Are you the calling that you're in is the calling that you would pick? Or do you genuinely love teaching the 16-year-olds that much?
I like them. You know, I ask maybe questions more than I do tell them things. You probably can tell that because of the way I've written my book, but they are very thoughtful and they face a world that is very different than mine. And, we talk about the issues that are interesting and important to them in context of the scriptures that we're studying. And so I enjoy that because of where they are in the stage of their formulation of their minds, their religious beliefs, their worldview.
And it's a tremendous period of impact too. If you think like 16 and then, you know, they're starting to get to where they graduate from high school and then making the decisions about where they go to college or what they're going to do for a living. Like that is to be able to have that connection with a 16-year-old. I can remember certainly with my parents connected to some level, but there would be other people that spoke into my lives that I don't know that I truly recognized the influence that they had or that I allowed
now,
them to have. Yeah.
I'm sad because we split our time between Virginia and Utah now. And so, you know, I don't won't have that calling here as we move out to Utah for the summer. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll get it back when we come back to Virginia for the winter. But being a seasonal resident of Utah and Virginia, it means that I bounce around a bit in church callings.
And an interesting thing that we won't have time to unpack in this episode is why you would do winters in Virginia. I think you're supposed to go to places in the South and where it's warm and tropical and stuff like that. But we don't have time, David. We don't have time. I'm not going to question those, but I am eager to learn more about that and bring you into my in-group of... I'm still working on that. We'll get that all figured out. The last question we ask everyone, we ask you to interpret it however you may. The question remains, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith is, you know, it's that saying, who said it? You know, the glory of God is intelligence. Mm-hmm. And to say I'm intelligent is wrong, but I really like, I have a hunger to understand more about the human experience. I want to understand more about who am I, what do I need to do? I don't mean that in terms of kind of daily rituals. I mean, in terms of understanding what is the nature of Dave? Who is he? How do I want him to live these next years of his life in context of, religious values, doing good, being good, You know, what does that mean? So that part of our faith to me is very expansive and very motivating.
Yeah. I appreciate your time. Find all the links, like I mentioned, in the show notes. David, I hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you will be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, Chris at Alpine Lakes Travel, Rick McGee, Debbie Wanless, Chocolate Cake Bites Podcast, and the Tiger with a U will be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row. We really gotta go on the Cultural Hall show.